previously.
In terms of intercourse frequency, we know that there are some couples who feel that they should be having intercourse every single day to achieve pregnancy. And while that may be good for other reasons, and certainly not to take away from personal enjoyment, it's certainly not that necessary to have intercourse that frequently.
This is Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Hello, good afternoon. We are bringing you another edition of Beyond the Birds and Bees. I am Dr. Natalie Berger, and I'm here with Dr. Rinku Mehta. And we are two of the providers at Texas Fertility Center in Austin, Texas. I'd like to welcome you to our discussion today. So in terms of things, before we get to the meat of our show, just want to go over some light details. We know that technically this is still a bit of a steamy end of September, and apparently it's still going to be a high of 90 today, which I'm really looking forward to having something a little bit cooler pretty darn soon. But so far, we're hanging in there, and I realize that there is some excitement going on downtown, and Rinku, you know a little bit about the festival and social scene.
Yeah, today's...
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. Do you have a question for us?
Yes, I do. I am a current IVF patient. Okay. I just started my first cycle, and I'm currently at the stimulation phase.
Okay.
I have a question about exercise.
Okay.
I'm not sure if I should stop my exercise routine at this point or cut it back. I've read a lot of conflicting information online. So I was just wondering, I work out right now 3 times a week with a trainer, some moderate weightlifting and cardio mix, and then I do walking and things like that outside.
Okay. Yeah, that's actually a very common question that a lot of people have. Best to discuss it with your own physician because they kind of are better in tune with what's going on with you. But in general, we recommend that you can continue your regular exercise regimen. You know, it's not a good idea to pick up anything new that's of high intensity. But especially in IVF, if somebody is responding and has a lot of follicles in the ovaries, high-impact exercise can cause ovarian torsion, or, you know, so we usually say that do lower-impact activity. And also, we don't want you to exercise to the point that your body's, you know, being put through a lot of stress. So in general, to be on the safe side, we recommend that limit your exercise to about 45 minutes a day and don't do anything that's excessively high impact.
Okay, and is there anything with the watching your heart rate? I've read several things about keeping your heart rate at 140 or lower. Is that something that's valid?
140 or lower is a safe way to go. And the other thing you want to make sure is, you know, you don't get dehydrated and overheated. So I think that is a safe recommendation to follow.
Okay, thank you. I'll talk to my doctor about it also.
Great.
Thank you.
All right. And I believe we actually have Dr. Chris Hart on the line. Dr. Chris Hart is one of the providers at Hill Country OBGYN. And this is a group of OBGYNs, 4 docs, plus a PA in South Austin. Dr. Hart is an Austin native. She did do her med school at UTMB and then did her residency. I believe that was in Oregon. And she has a special interest in nutrition and exercise in pregnancy. And Dr. Hart, are you there?
I am.
Great, great. Well, welcome to our show, and thank you for joining us today.
Really appreciate you having me. Thanks.
Very cool. And we realize that weight and pregnancy, I mean, you must have a lot of questions that you hear from your OB patients about, you know, what is a good weight before pregnancy as well as what is an appropriate amount of weight gain during pregnancy.
And oh, definitely.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you tell your patients?
Well, certainly. When I am seeing a patient who is coming to me before becoming pregnant and wants to know how she can have the best health during pregnancy, you know, first we have to assess what her health status is, you know, when she's thinking about becoming pregnant. You know, a large number, close to a third of reproductive age women these days are overweight or obese. And so if she's already overweight or obese, we want to do as much as we can to, you know, normalize her weight prior to becoming pregnant, generally we recommend approaching a normal body mass index anywhere between 18 and 25 for the BMI. And so if she is, above that, we want to do what we can to get her to a normal weight, or even to get her some improvement. Some studies suggest that even just a 5 or 10% decrease in weight can improve her chances of having a normal, successful pregnancy. For those women who are of a normal weight, we want to address maintaining a normal weight and watching their weight gain and making sure they maintain a normal, healthy weight gain during pregnancy.
And so if someone is overweight or obese before pregnancy, what kind of recommendations do you have in terms of diet or exercise to get them to a point to be the healthiest before they attain pregnancy?
Well, there are, certainly what you hear most commonly for strategies for improving weight, go back to are they exercising at the recommended daily exercise, which is, at least 30 minutes of moderate exercise on most days of the week? Are they hitting that goal? Are they, getting the right amount of caloric intake during the day with, with eliminating empty calories, things like sodas and sweetened teas and juices that may not contribute much to their nutritional status but carry a wallop of calories? Are they watching for fried foods in their diet? I usually encourage my patients to keep a journal of what they eat, when they eat. Are there triggers outside of hunger that are causing them to ingest calories? And so they can get a good idea of what their baseline nutritional status really is. Because if they can identify, gosh, I was really stressed at work and I, ate a pint of ice cream and drank two sodas because I was tired in the afternoon, those kind of things, those are the first, certainly the easy things to identify for improving their weight prior to pregnancy.
So, Chris, is a pregnancy a free ticket to eat whatever you want if you improve your weight before pregnancy?
Oh, I wish. I wish it was, because our bodies really, really give us those signals to chow down. Because food, it tastes so good and smells, some foods smell good when you're pregnant. But, our bodies are really sending us signals to eat quite a bit. And unfortunately, it is easy to gain weight during pregnancy. Most people don't need any additional calories outside of the calories that they need to maintain their weight in the first trimester, and only need a few hundred extra in the second and third trimester, which is about the equivalent of half a sandwich and an 8-ounce glass of milk. That's really all the extra calories that you can take during pregnancy and maintain a healthy weight gain.
And I think that's one of the most surprising things that people hear about is just how little extra caloric intake you really need to maintain normal pregnancy if you're of normal weight. A few hundred calories. I mean, that's not that we should be, suggesting candy bars, but a candy bar or half a sandwich or, two cups of yogurt. I mean, it's really not as much as you would think. And for all those folks who've been told you're eating for two, well,
right.
It's not quite
right.
Two adults. It's like two adults and a little nugget.
Unfortunately, yeah.
So what kind of things do you worry about as an obstetrician if someone is gaining too much weight during pregnancy, or even if they get pregnant when they were obese or, quite overweight? What are the things that you discuss with them as far as risks during pregnancy?
Well, I think this can and should be the motivating factor for those women who are already obese or overweight and want to get pregnant. Right away in pregnancy, those women who are obese have an increased risk of having an early pregnancy loss, a first trimester miscarriage. We don't know exactly what the link is, but that's definitely consistent. They have an increased risk of stillbirth, babies passing away during pregnancy, and an increased risk of babies having congenital anomalies, things like cleft palate and neural tube defects. And then women during pregnancy are going to have an increased risk of pregnancy complications, things like gestational diabetes, preeclampsia. They're less likely to have a successful vaginal delivery. They're increased risk for having a rest of labor, needing augmentation of labor, and having a failed vaginal delivery, needing a C-section. And so there are definitely, you know, good motivating factors to have a normal pregnancy weight and maintain a normal pregnancy weight gain.
And even with C-section, if the baby is too big or the woman is very obese, that's much more technically difficult. And
their operating times can be much longer due to, just the technical difficulty of the procedure. Problem that these days, you know, many women are awake for their C-sections and they get spinal anesthesia and so they can see their baby right away, but spinal anesthesia can be much more technically difficult when women are obese, and they may not be able to have a spinal anesthetic and may require general anesthesia where you go to sleep and won't, you know, have to wake up and won't be able to see the baby right away. And so that too can be sort of a disappointing complication from obesity. And then certainly the wound is more likely not to heal well and may get infected at a higher frequency.
So if you have a patient who comes to you and is already overweight or obese, you know, what are your recommendations for overall weight gain in pregnancy, or even for the normal patient coming into you? Like, what kind of recommendations do you give to them for overall weight gain?
Well, for my normal weight patients, I usually recommend a weight gain somewhere between 25 and 35 pounds for the pregnancy. If my patients fall into the overweight category, which is a BMI between 25 and 30, I usually recommend 15 to 25 pounds. And then those patients who are obese, less than 20 pounds, sort of 10 to 20 pounds for the weight gain. Now, some patients, that are morbidly obese, now this is a smaller group, of course, can be expected to maintain their weight during pregnancy. You know, not gain and not lose is ideal.
So for those women that are morbidly obese, that you don't really want them to gain any more weight during pregnancy, of course, you never want somebody to diet while they're pregnant.
Right.
Do you then recommend sort of a caloric guideline or have them see a nutritionist to help them maintain that weight?
I think I refer patients to nutritionists with a lot of frequency. I think a licensed clinical nutritionist can be invaluable for those patients who really have weight gain concerns during pregnancy and can help them, increase their activity level, maintain a healthy diet that's got a good amount of protein, carbohydrate, and fat to help them maintain their weight, but also grow a healthy baby.
Mm-hmm. And Struben, talking about normal BMI, overweight BMI, and obese BMI, and just to clarify for listeners who might not be familiar with what BMI is, this is the body mass index. And I think the easiest way probably to figure out what your personal BMI is to go to the internet and type in BMI calculator. And then
you'll get about a 5 dozen different calculators.
Yeah. And that way there's, you don't have to do any kind of complicated math or anything exotic there. You just sort of type in your height and your weight and you get a sense as to where you fall. Are you of a normal body mass index? Could you be underweight, overweight, or even obese? And that way you can get a sense as to sort of where you fall and what your risks may be, how much you should be worried about some of these complications during pregnancy, and even for fertility reasons as well, too. And
I think that's really important. I think a lot of people actually tend to underestimate where they fall in their BMI. They've definitely seen that people who are overweight may consider themselves to have a normal BMI. People who are obese may consider themselves just overweight. And so really important to, look at this realistically prior to pregnancy and make the necessary changes.
It's true. I think it's so important to be honest with yourself. And I realize it can be the cold, hard truth when you're looking at a BMI calculator and realizing that you're all of a sudden in a category you didn't think that you were in. But it's important to understand that and to take steps to improve your health, even if you're not trying to get pregnant or such. But it's certainly, people of a body mass index have far fewer medical problems. And it's certainly would be a great goal to try to move people in the direction of having a normal body weight for their height for multiple reasons. But I just wanted to mention that just in case anybody was confused about, what BMI is and how to figure that out.
Now that obesity is such a problem and just about an epidemic here in the United States, I read some alarming statistics the other day that 30% of people in Texas were obese, not just overweight, actually obese. And it's so important for all of us as physicians to make sure we counsel our patients appropriately. And, you know, just making that step is scary even to physicians, because for us, like, for instance, fertility specialists, the person's there to get pregnant, and then we start discussing weight, and they're like, wait, I'm not here for that. I just want you to help me get pregnant. So, you know, primary care doctors and OBGYNs such as yourself, you know, counseling these people early on gets them kind of in tune to, look, you know, I've got to lose some weight, not only to optimize my health, but also to optimize the health of my baby. Because when the baby is too big, they, you know, studies have shown that they in childhood will start experiencing obesity issues, and then they'll be obese adults, and it's just a self-propagating cycle at that point.
I think that's really important, and I think as a primary OBGYN, sometimes we get, you know, we hesitate to bring up people's weight because, you know, we don't want to offend or cause people to think badly toward us. But, generally when people are overweight, they know it's a concern. And I think we can, you know, perhaps suggest strategies and possibilities for improvement that maybe they hadn't been offered before. And so I think it is important to make that jump and say, let's have you thought about your weight? Do you consider yourself overweight? And just start that conversation.
Yeah, I think, you know, just so our patients know, we're not trying to irritate them by bringing this up. It's certainly, we're trying to look out for their best interests, and it can certainly be easier to intervene sooner rather than later when things get more out of control. I think that also another problem is that a lot of patients look at the people around them, their friends, their relatives and such, and they may feel like, gosh, I'm just like them. So because there is such a high percentage of people who are overweight, I think that it can be a little bit misleading. When you look around, you realize, you know, that you look like your friends and relatives and such. And I guess people then start thinking, well, gosh, so-and-so had 3 kids, no problems, yeah, no problems with pregnancy. Why should I be worried?
You know, right.
And I think there tends to be that kind of, what you would call it, but justification for maybe not trying to take some steps beforehand to try really improve the health of pregnancy. But, again, we just need to be honest and realistic about health and the impact of weight on health, especially, you know, as we're talking today about pregnancy and fertility.
Yeah, and, you know, some studies, and as you mentioned, Chris, before, that being overweight and obese does increase the chance of miscarriage. And, you know, especially for us, you know, when going through fertility treatment, when a person does get pregnant and then they end up having a miscarriage, is devastating to everybody involved. And if we can minimize lifestyle factors that may contribute to that, such as being overweight, that would be wonderful. But we do realize that it is hard. You know, people that are overweight didn't get that way overnight, and it takes a lot of effort and work to get back to normal weight. But again, you know, it doesn't even have to be back to a normal BMI.
Exactly.
Even about a 5 to 10% weight loss can significantly improve some of the metabolic parameters that contribute to these increased risks and greatly improve chances of having a successful pregnancy and delivery.
And I think that's probably a tribute to the lifestyle that people have to engage in to lose just that little bit of weight. They're improving their lifestyle so much, in terms of their calories intake, their exercise, and so you don't have to go from 220 to 120. You just have to start the lifestyle changes that put you in the right direction.
Right, and these changes are those that they need to maintain for the rest of their life. It's not a fad diet. It's, you've got to change the way you eat and just the nutritional status, you know, like eliminate McDonald's and eliminate sodas. You know, water was the liquid God created, wanted us to drink for the most, you know. So people that are overweight, if they pay attention to the little things that add up as calories, that in and of itself can take them a long way.
It's true that, you know, I think that up until recently we were thinking that, you know, the weight was related to sort of half diet and half exercise. But I think more information that we're getting these days is actually the larger component really is the diet, like what you're actually eating.
Yeah.
Exercise plays a part, and certainly building up muscle mass can help in terms of improving metabolism.
But even I was talking to a trainer the other day, and this is a person who focuses on exercise as well as nutrition to some extent too. But even he was saying that it's probably 70% diet and 20%, you know, cardiovascular exercise, maybe 10% weight training would sort of be the breakdown of what he thinks would be the most effective in terms of approaching weight loss. And so, yes, it's important to exercise, but you really have to be conscientious about what you're eating, because as many of us know, when you look at how sobering it is to, I don't know, even walk 3 miles, and how many calories does that actually burn? it's not as much as you would think, and it doesn't negate the Whopper that you had for lunch. So, yeah, it's true that diet and exercise are both important, but I think especially from what I'm hearing recently from research and such, is that really the diet is the major component of the weight loss. And I'm wondering also, in terms of exercise, what do you tell your patients, even pre-pregnancy, you know, recommendations? Do you refer them to any specific program, or do you give them sort of ideas as to what kind of exercises are good for weight loss?
Well, you know, certainly I think you really did hit the nail on the head there. Cardiovascular exercise, aerobic exercise, things like running, swimming, and you know, whatever sort of outdoor activities people may enjoy, are really important for cardiovascular health and to help to maintain weight. But it really is calorie restriction that sort of affects the weight loss. And so I generally, you know, stick to the recommendations, pregnant and non-pregnant, you know, for cardiovascular health and good placental function, to exercise at least 30 minutes on, you know, 4 or 5 days of the week, some sort of moderate activity to get your heart rate going. For my pregnant patients, you know, the recommendations are the same, except we don't want them engaging in any activity that they may be at risk for, you know, a trauma, a fall from a height, or getting hit, you know, like a, you know, taekwondo class or something like that.
Don't jump on a trampoline?
No, I usually recommend not jumping on trampolines. Yeah.
Now, Chris, what do you tell them about weight training when you're pregnant?
You know, I encourage people to maintain their weight training. I usually recommend keeping the weights lifted to less than 30 pounds and to avoid any recumbent, you know, flat on your back weight training, just because that can decrease perfusion to the uterus. But otherwise, that they can maintain their strength training as well, because that's important to help support their joints, which are going to be under significantly increased stress during their pregnancy.
And also, you know, I remind people too, it's like, you know, we used to think of pregnancy as this delicate state that you want to be very careful about and not engage in any kind of extra physical activity. But the irony of it all is that at the very end of pregnancy, you have this like major marathon called labor and delivery, for a lot of folks at least. And, you know, it's ironic that back in the day, we were having people sort of be relatively sort of low exercise states. And then all of a sudden they were expected to, you know, try to have this very physical experience of labor and delivery.
Right.
And so if anything that can be helpful in terms of preparing for that ultimate stage. And I'm also wondering, actually, what do you tell people who have not been exercising, who come to you newly pregnant?
Well, I recommend, you know, I have heard, you know, I think in the past the recommendations were not to start a new exercise program during pregnancy, but those recommendations have definitely been updated. The recommendation now for my sedentary patients is to start an exercise, start slow. You know, we usually recommend 20 minutes of a light to moderate activity on 3 days of the week, and increase from there to get to the recommended physical activity. And so even for my sedentary patients, I recommend starting with walking, you know, and try to do that 2 or 3 nights a week, and increase it gradually, enlist their partner or their family or friend to help them and to get started, because it definitely is good for their cardiovascular health, which in turn is going to translate into the perfusion and blood flow to that baby.
And that's so true that even as little as just 20 to 30 minutes of walking at least five times a week can significantly, you know, just keep your kind of metabolism going and you're not in this slow, sedentary state of metabolism. And from what I've read in the past, and I, you know, as a resident a long time ago, that even women that develop gestational diabetes, if they just take up walking every day, that can significantly improve their blood sugar control. Is that
definitely
correct?
It's definitely true. And that's true for patients with both type 2 and gestational diabetes. Increasing that insulin sensitivity can improve their blood sugars and thus translate into babies that have a more normal birth weight and a better chance of delivering vaginally and doing well after the birth.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciated your insight on weight and pregnancy and such. And thank you again for
enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Very cool. Well, thank you again. And what we're going to do is take a short break, and then we're going to talk a little bit more about ovulation stuff in general. Again, we're on at Beyond the Birds and Bees at Talk Radio 1370. For callers who are wanting to call in, the number is 390-1370.
Hello, and welcome back to Beyond the Birds and Bees with Texas Fertility Center. I'm Dr. Rinku Mehta, and my co-host on the show today is Dr. Natalie Berger. And on today's show, we are talking about ovulation, ovulatory dysfunction, as well as the impact of weight on fertility and pregnancy. We just had Dr. Chris Hart from Hill Country OBGYN with us, who discussed various strategies about weight during pregnancy. For more information about our center, you can visit www.txfertility.com. Also, we have many events coming up, seminars for patient information, and you can visit our event calendar for more information about that. Well, back to our show. For those who are just catching up, in their last segment, we discussed that caloric restriction is a very important aspect of weight loss. Exercise is also important, but it's really the calories that are going to get you there. And as we talked about it, we realized that we should kind of clarify that a little bit more. While we do recommend caloric restriction, there is a different level of caloric restriction appropriate for each person, and a visit with a nutritionist would be very useful to help clarify what's right for an individual. But more and more studies have come out lately that have said that fueling your body constantly throughout the day is a much better way to go than to eat just two or three large meals a day, which means that you should probably be eating every 3 to 4 hours small meals to keep your metabolism constantly fueled. Also, breakfast is an extremely important meal of the day. Your body has gone into starvation mode overnight, and if you don't eat in the morning, it stays in that mode and your metabolism is slowed down. Also, you tend to get hungrier later in the day and overeat later in the day. So always important to make sure you eat a good, healthy breakfast to start your day and then eat small, frequent meals.
Great. And some people actually also gain benefit from having a lower glycemic index diet. And for the people in our world, the fertility world, classically these patients are people with PCOS, which is polycystic ovarian syndrome. And these are patients who have irregular periods and classically ovaries with multiple follicles. They may have as well some additional issues and symptoms of, say, acne or excess hair growth in certain areas. Because patients with PCOS are at risk for diabetes down the road and seem to have sort of a pre-diabetic metabolism at times, those folks especially seem to benefit from something called a lower glycemic index diet. And long story short, it basically is a scenario where you're trying to not have simple sugars and simple carbohydrates in and of themselves. And something that you can certainly talk to nutritionists more about in terms of how to design eating plan. But it's important not to have meals which just consist of
bread products without adding proteins or lean vegetables, because this can help to overall stabilize the blood sugar. And it falls into sort of a semi-diabetic diet, but it's not quite as restrictive as a diabetic diet. So it's something that, you know, especially PCOS patients in our practice may consider talking to a nutritionist or investigating more, because it may be helpful for them in terms of losing weight and stabilizing their blood sugar.
You know, and a lot of times people say, well, you know, I can't afford to eat healthy because it's so much cheaper to go to KFC or, you know, go get junk food. But the truth is, you don't have to eat organic. You just have to watch for the food choices that you do make. Instead of buying that loaf of white bread in the grocery store, buy the loaf that says the first ingredient is whole grain wheat flour. So if you, you know, paid attention to the nutritional labeling and just chose things that are made out of whole grains and whole wheat flour, yeah, that's always a good choice. Also, as Dr. Berger mentioned, staying away from just refined foods, such as just foods containing a lot of sugar. While, you know, that is a very simple carbohydrate, it causes spikes of insulin in your system. It also is packed with calories. So, you know, instead of eating that one piece of chocolate cake, you could have a whole other healthy meal that will leave you very satisfied. So these are little conscious choices that you can make to improve things overall.
I think this is also where nutritionists can really be helpful, because, you know, we are certainly not the experts in nutrition, though we are very aware that sugar is a very sneaky hidden item in many foods. Things you would never think of that would have sugar, if you look at the label, all of a sudden you see a second or third ingredient is sugar. And a lot of things that are labeled low fat or non-fat, what the company does to make up for the lack of flavor from the lack of grease or fat is to put more sugar into the product. So you have to be a little bit careful about looking at things that are low fat or non-fat as the best product overall. And again, you know, other additives in addition to sugars, if you see things that contain high fructose corn syrup, and there are other types of highly processed sugars as well, too. You just want to be conscious of that. Even things like ketchup. I mean, ketchup is like, you know, a lot of kids love ketchup, adults love ketchup, but it's interesting how sugary ketchup is. And again, many of the foods that you eat that you're not aware of certainly can have a pretty high sugar content. And it's interesting to look at the ingredients to really see what it is that you're eating.
Now, weight can also affect ovulation. Mm-hmm. What kind of impact can increased weight have on ovulation?
Well, certainly it's more common for people who carry extra weight to have increasing problems with ovulation. And as we talked about at the very beginning, ovulation is simply the release of the egg from the ovary in the midpoint of the menstrual cycle. And for folks who have regular cycles, roughly every 28 days, but sometimes maybe 24 days or 35 days. You know, this happens pretty consistently, but for people who are having much more variation in terms of their cycles, for instance, every 2 months they have a period, these folks have what's considered ovulation dysfunction. And basically it means to us they're not releasing an egg at a specific periodic time every month. They may be occasionally releasing an egg, but not with any kind of frequency.
And in increased weight, some of the theories that are out there suggest that being overweight and having increased adiposity can increase resistance to insulin, and insulin resistance can then lead to other things that lead to ovulatory dysfunction. So just losing even a little bit of weight can help some anovulatory women resume normal ovulatory function. And also in those women that do have regular cycles and ovulate regularly, being overweight can actually decreases their chances of getting pregnant per month. I recently read some statistics that said that it can decrease your chances of conception by up to 30% to 40% per cycle, and that is profound. What a degree impact.
Well, especially even though certainly we have a lot of strategies in the fertility world to improve ovulation, to make it more regular, you know, the fact that folks possibly can on their own improve and make their ovulation more regular means that they may not have the cost of fertility treatment or the higher chances of twins or more. So certainly any strategies that you can do on your own to improve your ovulation by losing even small amounts of weight if you're overweight can definitely be in your favor. And, you know, one thing that we want to sort of talk about is if someone is not ovulating regularly, meaning they're not having regular periods, are people only with fertility problems at risk for issues, or should all people with ovulation problems be aware of this?
A lot of it also depends on the cause of the anovulation or the lack of ovulation. In about 10% of reproductive age women have polycystic ovary syndrome, which is a common cause of ovulatory dysfunction. And in such women, although they're not trying to get pregnant, if they're not having periods for long periods of time, we worry about them because they can get what's called endometrial hyperplasia. The lining of the inside part of the uterus grows too much, and it can eventually develop abnormal cells that, if unchecked for a long time, can lead to endometrial cancer. So we always want to protect these patients against that. And if they're not trying to get pregnant, sometimes we recommend that they go on the oral contraceptive or even monthly get a medication called progesterone to have them help have a period, essentially to protect their uterus.
So even people who are not trying to get pregnant currently with irregular periods should still be seen by a provider of some sort, an OBGYN or internist or regular doctor, just to make sure that they are protecting themselves against some of the health risks associated with irregular periods. And classically, in terms of ovulation problems, if you have irregular periods, your provider would typically do some sort of blood work to make sure that there is nothing otherwise that's contributing to a problem, like a thyroid problem or prolactin hormone problem, or that your ovaries are starting to tire. But there's a pretty basic and simple evaluation. And again, even people who are not trying to get pregnant, but especially people who are trying to get pregnant, should see someone if they're having irregular periods.
I agree. And, you know, last but not the least, if weight is a concern, we would recommend that you see a provider for it. It's always okay to get help. A lot of us try to do this on our own and are not always successful. A lot of times doing it together with somebody, getting written guidelines, getting some sort of motivating factors, such as wanting to get pregnant or having a healthier baby, all of these things do help. So it's always okay to get help early on to help optimize your health before you get pregnant, or even if you're already pregnant, you can still make improvements.
Well, thank you very much for joining us at Beyond the Birds and Bees. And this has been Drs. Rinku Mehta and Natalie Berger. Next week, we're going to be talking with Dr. Sandeep Mistry and Kaylin Silverberg regarding male factor and female sexual dysfunction. Take care, guys.
Let me tell you about the birds and the bees, the flowers and the trees, the moon up above.